today on Against the Grain. As threats to the environment grow in number and severity, many of us see conservation as an urgent imperative, as an unmitigated good. But as Anuradha Mittal has discovered, what's being done to the Maasai people in Tanzania in the name of conservation is horrific. I'm CS. I'll speak with Anuradha about a revealing and scathing report issued by the Oakland Institute, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Conservationists do a lot of good in this world. Conservation groups are lauded for protecting this habitat or that ecosystem. Initiatives to address pollution and to ward off extinction are being tirelessly pursued around the globe. But what if conservation efforts don't always serve the interests of justice? What if they disregard or even harm, for example, indigenous people? A new report put out by the Oakland Institute reveals that foreign conservation and tourism companies operating in Tanzania, companies often backed by the Tanzanian security forces, are endangering the lives and livelihoods of the indigenous Maasai people. Far from being viewed as integral to the landscape and worthy of protection, the Maasai are being targeted, displaced, threatened, and even denied the right to grow food. The Oakland Institute's report, entitled Losing the Serengeti, also shows how the Maasai have been historically pushed off their ancestral lands by conservation laws and schemes. Anuradha Mittal is executive director and founder of the Oakland Institute, a policy think tank, and she is co-author with Elizabeth Fraser of the report. When Anuradha joined me recently in studio, I asked her about the Serengeti, which has been the land of the Maasai for centuries.
Serengeti, which I learned when I was in Tanzania and in the region itself, in the language of the Maasai, which is Ma, means the land that runs forever. Serengeti for most of us is what we know by watching National Geographic or Discovery Channels, this image of savanna lands, this wildlife migration, lions and wild beasts and giraffes and cheetahs. It is actually quite like that, but what often we do not see is this landscape which is interspersed not just with wildlife, but the Maasai, these tall, beautiful people in their red-purple shukas, which are like these shawls, as they graze their cattle and the symbiotic relationship that they have with the land and the wildlife.
And they are, as you write, a semi-nomadic ethnic group. Semi-nomadic meaning?
Well, they definitely keep cattle and they move from place to place to find places for their pasture. But a lot of people do not realize that the Maasai also cultivate small subsistence gardens. And they have done that for a very long time to be able to sustain their livelihoods and to ensure food for their families.
Tell us more about how important cattle and cattle grazing are to Maasai culture and livelihoods.
Well, I think the best way to describe the relationship that the Maasai have with the cattle or with the cows is really through the words of this Maasai man that I met when I was in the region. Right from childhood, children are taught about the sacred relationship they have with cows. They are taught how to take care of cows, how to be in the wild, how when it gets too dark, how to return home safely with the cows. Also, this is a relationship with an animal which is not just based or raised to kind of hunt and eat it, but it is really a relationship which is based on recognizing that the existence of cow is necessary for their own livelihoods. So for all religious cultural ceremonies, there's blood drinking of the cows, but without killing the animal. The milk of the cows is necessary for the children to drink, to have necessary nutrition. And again, it's a very beautiful relationship that most of us don't realize, perhaps, that the Maasai are needed for conservation. They don't eat game. They do not eat the wild beast or the giraffes, but they basically use the land in harmony with their cattle as they graze. And it is a relationship described, you know, over generations, built over generations, and they're very much a part of the landscape. The landscape is incomplete without the Maasai and the cattle.
How long have the Maasai lived in the Serengeti, and what happened to them when the first European colonizers arrived?
Well, the Maasai, as we mentioned in the report, have lived in the East Africa Rift Valley for centuries, moving from place to place. But our report really details what happened when the colonizers arrived in that region. So for instance, through land laws that were passed, suddenly the customary land rights of the Maasai were ignored and the land was seen as belonging to the colonial power. Not just that, when the Maasai lost almost like 1 million hectares of land at that time, suddenly by this passage of a law from the outsiders, but in the 50s, the whole idea of creating the Serengeti was basically done by asking the Maasai to leave those lands.
So this is forming the Serengeti National Park.
That's correct. When the Serengeti National Park was being created, it was, imagine Yosemite Park being created, the idea of a national park without the forest communities who have lived there forever. The Maasai were told that they would be moved to other areas, such as the Gorongoro Conservation Area, and that they would be able to stay there. And if ever there's a conflict between their rights and conservation, priority would be given to the rights of the Maasai. Of course, none of this was written down, whereas the Maasai in writing gave up their rights to the area which is now the Serengeti National Park.
We're going to talk more about what's happened to the Maasai under some of these land laws and other decisions made by governments and other entities in Tanzania. But I want to get right now to the Tanzania Conservation Limited. This is one of the companies that the Maasai are at odds with and are in litigation with. Tell us about Tanzania Conservation Limited, what it does and who runs it.
Well, Tanzania Conservation Limited is a company which is run by the same couple who own the very high-end safari outfitter in Boston called Thompson Safaris. Rick and Judy Wineland are the owners of Thompson Safari, and they also own Tanzania Conservation Limited. The dispute is over 12,617 acres of land. And the three villages in Tanzania, the Maasai villages, have brought a legal challenge against the illegal takeover of their lands by Tanzania Conservation Limited. They have also, in their case, alleged that the company has been responsible of colluding with the government and basically denying access to grazing lands, denying the villagers access to watering holes for their cattle, of preventing children's access to schools. There are reports of villagers being beaten up, arrested, intimidated when the company has called in the police. There are several allegations. In 2015, however, the court in Arusha ruled that none of these allegations were true. But it did recognize that at least 2,617 acres of land were illegally occupied by Tanzania Conservation Limited. However, no compensation, no way of reparations was made to the Maasai. The Maasai villagers have appealed the decision of the court, but also feeling frustrated that there is no rule of law where, given the collusion between the safari companies and the government officials, they are looking at international mechanisms such as the African Commission on People and Human Rights Court, for instance.
So Tanzania Conservation Limited, it purchased a 96-year lease to the 12,000-plus acres of land in its northern Tanzania in 2006. Where is the land and how was it used by, well, I guess it's within these three villages or it encompasses the three villages you mentioned. And how was that land acquired by TCL? How was it used by Maasai villagers?
Well, the villagers allege that before TCL, Tanzania Breweries Limited actually acquired the land. And through some of the company documents that we were able to procure, it appears that villagers who did not own that land actually sold off or agreed for this land to be taken over. So the three villagers say that they were never compensated to start off when the lands were acquired by the TBL. Tanzania Breweries Limited, however, did not use those lands, so the villagers continued to bring their cattle to graze, to get access to the water. And according to Tanzanian law, that becomes adverse possession when a land is not being used by the so-called owner, and other communities, villagers have been back in the land for almost 10 years, it becomes their land. However, as you mentioned, Tanzania Conservation Limited acquired this lease from Tanzania Breweries Limited. By the way, the purpose of that lease was to grow corn and other things. It was not meant for safari purposes or to be used as bringing in foreign tourists. So that change of the use of land never happened. And when TCL came in, the villagers allege that suddenly their access to water, to grazing land, to intimidation, to arrest. And again, while we say these allegations, on our website, we have made available internal documents of Thompson Safari, which show internal emails, which actually point to the veracity of these allegations of the villagers that they are being denied access to their own land.
And so what you were saying about this company, this tourism company, Tanzania Conservation Limited, denying access by the Maasai to grazing areas and watering holes. Is this all about them kind of keeping their land, as they see it, their land free of these villagers so that their tourism activities, that they can lure foreigners more effectively to this area?
I think you've said it very well. It is a situation where foreign tourists come in, having seen the Serengeti on the TV channels and the desire to see this pristine landscape with wildlife, as if nobody has ever lived there. So it is this perpetuation of the myth that we see on our television sets, which is then perpetuated by safari companies to enjoy this exotic experience of the savannah, of the Serengeti, where the Maasai are nothing more than a culture experience. So you might go to a cultural boma carefully set up for the tourist purposes to sing and dance and jump around to just appease our desire as a safari tourist. But the fact is, that is not the reality. The reality is that communities, villages, registered villages are on that land, have been there for generations, and to get the money from the rich tourists who are paying anywhere from $8,000 to $10,000 for that experience, the lives and livelihoods of the Maasai are being destroyed.
And the boma is the enclosure, is that right? Some kind of enclosure?
That's correct. So several homes, huts will come together to form like a small boma. So a boma would have several huts, which might belong to the same family or extended family or others.
That's the voice of Anuradha Mittal. She is executive director of the Oakland Institute and co-author with Elizabeth Frazier of the new Oakland Institute report, Losing the Serengeti, the Maasai land that was to run forever, which reveals how foreign companies operating in Tanzania are devastating the indigenous Maasai people in the name of conservation. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Okay, so you have these companies, and you began with Tanzania Breweries Limited acquiring the property in 1984 and then selling it in some way to Tanzania Conservation Limited. So you have TBL getting the property without community consent, no consultation, and then you have Tanzania Conservation Limited coming in and doing these things and harassing villagers, making life very difficult for them, denying them access to lands and to water. You would hope, Anuradha, that the Tanzanian government, right, so local and national and, I don't know, regional governments would do something to protect Tanzanians, in this case the Maasai, from this violence, these threats, the intimidation, the evictions. What's happened?
Well, that's an excellent question. I think, again, as the internal documents of Thompson Safari reveal, there's a close collusion between the foreign companies and the government officials. You know, the ability to contact district commissioner who immediately will send in the police and arrest and lock up the local villagers. And we also have to see the reality of the Tanzanian government. In addition to collusion, there is a history of denial of the existence of indigenous populations in Tanzania. The government has, in fact, in a report that was done by the African Commission looking into some of the allegations in 2013, they were told that how can you call Maasai are indigenous because some of them are professors. So the idea of indigenous is to be a backward tribe. And that understanding or their theory of development is to sacrifice the livelihoods of the indigenous populations in the so-called larger common good for the country.
So this report comes from, emerges out of a lot of on-the-ground research that you did in Tanzania. So you were talking to villagers, you were gathering documents, and as you approached at least two Maasai herders, and I'm sure this happened on a number of occasions, they began running away from you, leaving their cattle behind. Why did they run?
That's exactly the question I asked. Was surprised that as a vehicle approached, that the young herders, like in other instances, people would start running away. What was later explained to me when we connected with them was that they're terrified because they don't know who the vehicle belongs to. They were afraid that it was the guards of the safari companies and game parks that are operating in the area. So they tend to run away, hoping that the cattle will not be confiscated or killed. This is just a small snippet of the climate of fear that the local villagers live with that I got to witness and experience.
Have journalists and researchers who have investigated Tanzania Conservation Limited and Thompson Safaris, have they also faced harassment?
There are journalists who report having to hide in ditches to do the interviews. There are experiences of journalists who talk about how they were arrested, the computer seized, and then they were deported. Some of them are now persona non grata or a prohibited immigrant in Tanzania, which means they cannot enter the country. The most disturbing, however, is the case of Trent Keegan, a journalist from New Zealand, who 10 years ago now was in the region looking at the plight of the Maasai in the Loliondo region. He wrote to some of his friends that he was worried for his safety. He was sharing photographs of some very disturbing, you know, happenings on the ground, which were linked to Thompson Safari. And then he left for Kenya, where he was battered to death. Nobody has ever ruled who is responsible for the killing of Trent Keegan. However, it is quite disturbing that while all the money, his visa cards were still on him, what was missing is his computer and his camera and phone.
Let's talk about a second conservation slash tourism company operating in Tanzania. It's also the focus of your Oakland Institute report, Losing the Serengeti. This is the Ortello Business Corporation, and it arrived in this region, Loliondo, in 1992 and was granted a hunting license, a license to hunt in an area called a game-controlled area. Who came to that area to hunt?
Ortello Business Corporation is a UAE-based company. It is not a company that you and I can sign up for a hunting excursion. It runs hunting excursions exclusively for the royal family of the UAE.
Which is the United Arab Emirates.
That's correct. And when you actually arrive in that region, your cell phone changes to actually say that you're in a region which is basically owned and controlled by the United Arab Emirates. They have their own private airstrip. They have been in the region for 25 years now, and it has been a history of absolute devastation for the local communities. Several times over the years, there have been burning of bomas, Thousands of the Maasai have been left homeless. These issues have been covered by international media in 2009, 2015, and most recently, just last year in August, where nearly 20,000 Maasai were left homeless after their homes were burnt in areas which are registered villages at the orders of the Tanzanian government in the name of promoting tourism.
So you're saying that homes and communities have been burned with the consent of the Tanzanian government, and I assume this is to benefit the operations of Ortello Business Corporation?
That's exactly what I was saying, that these actions have been led by the Tanzanian government, by its guards, at the behest of Ortello Business Corporation. Last year, what is absolutely stunning is that these actions were carried out in August. By November, Minister of Tourism and Natural Resources came out and stopped those burning of the bomas and in fact cancelled the hunting license of the OBC. There were allegations of corruption, of millions of dollars of having been paid to the ministers of tourism and the Department of Tourism. There were allegations of rare and endangered species being killed by the royal family. While we are talking about conservation, they have built a private airstrip in this very special area. So much for conservation. And of course, the conflict with the community in Loliondo. What is even more shocking is that after cancellation of that hunting license, this March, Minister of Tourism sent out a tweet welcoming the royal family back for its hunting license.
Officials gave as one reason for the evictions of these Maasai villagers that the subsistence agriculture practiced by the Maasai was damaging the environment.
The reason that the ministry gives for carrying out these kind of burning of homes as they did last year was to promote tourism. So I think it is really a question to be asked of the government, as I was asked by villager after villager, that the laws of the Tanzanian government, which are prohibiting people from even being able to plant a small home garden, that when they can break the ground to bury the dead, because the government policies are causing widespread malnutrition, disease, and hunger. Children are dying. So if we can break the ground to bury the dead, why can't we break the ground to feed our families and communities?
Anuradha Mittal, M-I-T-T-A-L, founder and executive director of the Oakland Institute, a policy think tank that works to address the pressing social, economic, and environmental issues of our times. And we have a link on againstthegrain.org to the new Oakland Institute report. It's called Losing the Serengeti, the Maasai Land That Was to Run Forever. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So as you mentioned in this report, the OBC, the Ortello Business Corporation, it built water wells in several Maasai villages. And it was initially friendly, like when it arrived on the scene, it was initially friendly to villagers. I imagine you think this is part of some kind of broader strategy by the company?
So one of the things that became very obvious when I was on the ground meeting with villagers, that there is an attempt to divide and rule. So when their communities who are opposing and are strong in their resistance, given the kind of poverty there is on the ground, the companies are very quick to find individuals or villages that they can put some extra money in to buy their loyalty. So this is one of the big hardships on the ground where villages are turning against the other. So instead of this holistic, sustainable development, you not just have the destruction of lives and livelihoods, but no, the animosity between villages, which is of course not very conducive to the well-being of the people on the ground.
Tell us about some of the grassroots resistance against these two companies, Ortello Business Corporation and Tanzania Conservation Limited, because these people are not just victims. They're agents, and they are trying to do something about their plight. So what have they tried to do in relation to either the companies or the government, and what response have they gotten?
Thank you, CS, for asking this question, because one of the things I've really been struck by is the silence. Silence which comes from a very deep place of fear from the civil society. whether it is the international civil society, whether it is the national and local civil society in Tanzania, there's such fear. And the new laws that are being passed by the Tanzanian government around blogging and other things. So there's a lot of self-censorship. So in the midst of that, when you meet villagers, and unfortunately I cannot name them because of the threat that exists, as we had to blur every photograph in the report, we had to redact every name because there's no way to know how to protect them. But what was stunning was the courage of the people I spoke to. People would gather in the middle of the night because they could not have the word get out that there was a researcher meeting with them wanting to learn what was happening. So they would come in the middle of the night, gather around small fires, sharing their day-to-day life and experiences, exposing their wounds, and more important, their aspirations. For instance, I remember asking this woman, what would she like in terms of Thompson Safari? Would she like to somehow get to a peaceful resolution and be able to forge a way forward together? And she looked at me and she said, can you help me understand, how do you befriend someone who shot at you and your family? These are mothers and fathers. These are children who shared their stories. These are grandmothers who shared their stories of the fact that the children who have a right to education cannot go to the local school, that the cattle cannot have access to water, but most important, that they have to live with fear on their own land. When the guards come, they have to go running.
Do the safari companies ever hire Maasai villagers? Hire them, have them work for these companies?
Of course. I mean, you know, they do find some Maasai villagers to work for them. I think what is important to note is that the villagers that are in litigation, they are not working with these companies. And to, of course, rope in support from the neighboring villagers, they offer jobs, they offer all kind of opportunities for them to make more money. And this is a great way of divide and rule, as I mentioned before.
So you spoke earlier about kind of the history of foreign influence in Tanzania and the fact that over 1 million hectares of land were stolen from communities. And I think this was Germany, right? What Germany did to land ownership in Tanzania. And then it becomes a British colony, that country does, after World War I. And then you referred to how the British, I think it was, tried to set up the Serengeti National Park and said, no, humans can't live here. And that includes the Maasai, of course. And so the Maasai have to move and move to this designated conservation area. So the governing body of this conservation area was given the authority to regulate activities in the area. How momentous was this? And who sits on the governing body? And one would hope that the Maasai would have some representation on this body.
So yeah, so as you mentioned, the Maasai were moved from the Serengeti National Park to what is now called NCA, the Ngorongoro Conservation Area. This is the home to the famous Ngorongoro Crater. And the Maasai were assured that they would be able to live there. And the authority would be comprised of all the key stakeholders, which would include the Maasai. Over time, the Maasai were again told to move from the crater to open it just for conservation and for tourism to other registered villages. But then other laws came. For instance, they cannot graze, they cannot have small home gardens, there is no food aid. So the attempt is really to shrink them into smaller space till they're forced out to leave of their own choice. But the problem is there's nowhere else to go. The Maasai cannot go back to the Serengeti Park. They cannot go. There's no space in Loliondo. So where do they go? But also one of the things that has happened with the conservation authority is that initially there were some seats for the Maasai. But today, if you look at NCA, most of the jobs are not given to the Maasai in the area. The few educated who do go to college are not given jobs. So most of the guards, most of the rangers are from outside who have no understanding or appreciation of the Maasai culture or the way of life. So like many other parts of the world, it becomes how to push Maasai out of the area to create the best tourism spots and conservation. And that's been one of the biggest challenges.
Anuradha Mittal, Executive Director of the Oakland Institute, will take a short break and speak more with her about her report, Losing the Serengeti. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Anuradha Mittal is Executive Director of the Oakland Institute. It's a policy think tank. She is author and editor of numerous books and reports on issues relating to trade, development, human rights, and agriculture. And she joins us to discuss a report she co-authored. It's called Losing the Serengeti. And it examines what conservation and tourism companies and government security forces have done and are doing to endanger the lives and livelihoods of the indigenous Maasai people in Tanzania. You write in this report that in the years leading up to the 1970s, international conservation groups gained influence over conservation laws in Africa. Well, that sounds good, doesn't it? That you have these international conservation groups gaining some sway over how conservation is done in Africa. So what impact did that have on the Maasai?
Well, that's actually the unfortunate news, that Western conservation groups, which have a very myopic view of doing conservation by pushing the forest communities out to create these pristine landscapes, that is the model that they weighed in on. And that is the creation of these national parks in different countries in Africa. So what has really happened that we detail in our report is actually something that you can say is happening all over the world, where in the name of conservation, in the name of environmentalism, the governments, the private companies, and even the international organizations have colluded. And their policies have resulted in pushing the indigenous out of their own lands and out of existence.
And what you said at the beginning of this hour suggests that the Maasai living in the Serengeti were very good at conserving the land and conserving resources.
Well, you know, it's not something that I said it. There's enough scientific evidence that this semi-nomadic pastoralist way of life in the region is the best way to maintain the lands. These communities who depend on that land and have depended on it for generations, they are the best stewards of the land. The other thing I would share, just a personal experience, you know, being with the Maasai, experiencing seeing wild beast and ostrich and zebras and giraffes, I mean, there was an instinct in me to, you know, jump out of the car to take a photograph for my 10-year-old daughter. And every time these animals would run away. Till the Maasai man who was traveling with me gave me his shuka and said, next time you step out of the car, wear this red shawl. And it was incredible to step out of the car with the red shawl and nothing left, because they're so used to live in harmony with the Maasai as the cattle graze with the zebras and the wild beast and the giraffes. Nothing ran away and I could take the photographs.
In what way do these safari and conservation companies feel that even subsistence agriculture practiced by the Maasai would somehow hurt their business? I mean, we're talking about a lot of land, and one would think that even, you know, there would be cultural interest maybe in having tourists come over and, in conjunction with seeing the wild animals and the wild terrain, see indigenous people doing their things and leading their lives.
That is what you and I would think. I think it has been quite revealing in engaging with some of these companies. First of all, it is about power. This is our land. This is the land that we bought. This is our property. That mind frame, that way of looking at life, I own this land, it's so significantly different from the customary land rights and the relationship of Maasai with the land that the two just clash. You know, there's such a fault line between this Western way of thinking, I own this land because I paid this money, therefore I shall dictate what is done with it. It's a power relationship. It is rooted in this old-fashioned colonization when we thought we could go to different parts of Africa and own and control it. It is a power relationship that we can own the prime ministers and the presidents and the local officials in countries in a place like Africa. So I don't know how you change that. The other thing, as I said, is it has been perpetuated, this experience, this exotic experience of witnessing this wildlife. And wild means that there are no people there.
So you referred earlier to the hunger and poverty that these villagers are experiencing, and it makes sense, right? If they can't cultivate land and can't even set up little home gardens, how are they going to live? And they have cattle, but the grazing areas are being restricted. So what is their situation doing to family structures and the ability of families to stay together and care for each other?
I think what was the most shocking for us at the Institute was to see the level of malnutrition and hunger, which is linked to tourism, because that's something that has never been talked about. So we described these villages in detail, which are very close to some of the largest tourist destinations in northern Tanzania. You know, there are about 10,000 people living in these villages. They have been promised food aid because they're not allowed to cultivate, even to put in even one potato plant, as I was told by so many villagers. So there's rampant hunger. People basically, when they have food aid, they have corn meals. So you get two bowls of porridge with water, because if there is no milk, because the cows are not allowed to graze, so they're producing very little milk. And if there's any, it's for the children. So under these circumstances, you find so many children who have been orphaned because the mothers have been forced to leave for the cities where they're working as prostitutes, where they're forced to sell snuff. They're gone for months, 9, 10 months. There's nobody to take care of the children. Men are leaving because South Sudan, the whole image of a strong Maasai man as your guard. So they're leaving as guards for South Sudan, coming back in the civil war as dead bodies. You see villages after villages where you have children and the elderly, but there are no people to take care of these two groups of people. The kind of devastation and desperation you see in the eyes of the people is perhaps something I was not really prepared for, because there's been no media coverage of it, there's been no reports of it. But in 2013, nearly 500 children died in this area. The death was attributed to malaria, but the disease was really linked to malnutrition and the inability to fight disease. So this is really in violation of the Tanzanian government's own constitution, which guarantees the right to life, right to food. And yet its own citizens are being denied the right to life as they're being forced into starvation and death.
And the government's duty, for example, to prevent hunger is part of this report, is included in this report in a section about paths forward and how to address what's been exposed in this report. What needs to be done in terms of investigating the repression and oppression of the Maasai people and of restraining private entities and the government from harming and harassing villagers?
Well, the intent of our report was not to malign any specific company or the government of Tanzania, and that is why we suggest several ways forward. First of all, I mean, it's pretty obvious that this level of fear and intimidation and arrest have to immediately stop. And at the same time, an independent inquiry needs to be set in place, including the Maasai, to investigate what has gone on for the past few years and decades, where homes have been burnt, where people have been shot at. Secondly, the people should be allowed to cultivate as soon as possible. It is their land. They should be able to plant their home gardens, to feed their families, to feed themselves. And all kind of necessary support should be provided to these villages. We list a whole series of obligations that the Tanzanian government has, for instance, through its commitments to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the International Covenant on Economic, Social, Cultural Rights, the Convention on the Rights of the Indigenous Populations. So there are a lot of already obligations that the Tanzanian government, all it has to do is fulfill them and respect them. In terms of non-state actors, such as the Tanzania Conservation Limited or the Otolo Business Corporation, we have come a long way when it comes to human rights. Non-state actors also have obligations, and they should be held accountable to it.
Her name is Anuradha Mittal. She's executive director of the Oakland Institute. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. I found it interesting that your report cites certain legal decisions that affect indigenous groups in other nations. These decisions have been made by international and multilateral tribunals, and they offer certain legal resources to the Maasai, don't they?
Oh, definitely. In the report, for instance, we mentioned the 2001 ruling of the Inter-American Court for Human Rights, which recognized clearly the autonomy and the autonomous land rights of the indigenous populations in the Atlantic coast of Nicaragua, for instance. We have seen similar rulings around indigenous communities in Kenya. And in fact, it's almost a year now that we celebrated the recognition of the land rights of the communities in Kenya. So on one hand, we see the trend of the oppression of the indigenous communities, but we are seeing more and more of these cases being built. Now, what we have to work towards is implementation. Land rights of the indigenous, which have not been recognized for centuries, their time has come. Because if we do not recognize their land rights, it is basically putting them into extinction.
Yeah, and at least one of the cases you mentioned upheld the rights of the indigenous people, regardless of whether some agreement had been made or the land had been allocated in a certain way that marginalized these communities. In other words, it seems like certain rights to the land are inviolable according to some international cases.
And that is very significant. For when companies like Tanzania Conservation Limited hold up a piece of paper saying, but we have a lease, it's almost challenging what is legal, because we know a lot of dispossession has been legalized. This is what our report shows, that through land laws, conservation laws, it has been a very systemic way of dispossessing the Maasai of their own land, the customary land rights. So the cases and these wins in Africa, for instance, are very significant because they first again prioritize the land rights of the indigenous population first.
There is a locally grown mechanism in Tanzania that you think will help the Maasai people. What are certificates of customary right of occupancy?
Customary rights to occupancy, these are basically a new model of land titling, which is very exciting, and it is happening in Tanzania. Basically, it allows communities to get indivisible rights over land, and they have it as community rights. These are not individual rights. So the land is then managed through bylaws and management plans. So this is what in some places like India has been called community or joint participatory management. And we know it works when you start looking at it, whether it's in a place like India or whether it's in Tanzania. Communities who are the stewards of the land being given the responsibility and the power and the right, responsibility with right, to manage those joint lands jointly has led to better participation, has led to better management. So this is one of the ways forward that we suggest, that given the customary land rights, instead of pushing for individual titles, which again is a very Western concept of property ownership, to promote customary land rights, which are rooted in the indigenous culture and the way of life of Tanzania.
So I know this rehearses some of what you've been emphasizing this hour, but I want to read a paragraph from the conclusion of this report, again by the Oakland Institute. It's called Losing the Serengeti. Marcus Colchester, a British zoologist, once stated, "It is exactly because the areas that indigenous people inhabit have not been degraded by their traditional resource practices that they are now coveted by conservationists who seek to limit their activities or expel them altogether from their customary land." I mean, this really brings up, I think, an important point that these places are, to the extent that they're pristine, pristine because of the very people who are now being evicted from the land.
Yeah, it's a non-brainer. They are pristine because they've been taken care of. They've been cherished. There's been a rhythm of life that just, it's not property. It's not something they make money off. It is just something so sacred. And so as outsiders come in, the first instinct to own it, to control it, and to evict those who have protected is mind-boggling.
So what's happened and what is happening to the legal challenges against these safari companies? Again, Tanzania Conservation Limited, Uratello Business Corporation, instrumentalities of the Tanzanian government. So what is happening with these lawsuits that presumably, well, that definitely seek justice for the Maasai people?
Well, in the case of the three villages of Mandarosi, Sukenya, and that have brought a lawsuit against not just Tanzania Conservation Limited, but also TBL, as well as the Attorney General and the District Commissioners and others, their five parties, they have appealed the decision of the court in 2015, and that appeal is still being heard. In the case of Uratello Business Corporation, several civil society organizations had filed a case after the burning of the Bomas in 2009 under a special emergency request that it should be addressed right away. Nearly 10 years later, nothing has happened, though it was filed under the urgent situation that it should be addressed right away. This has forced the communities to basically say that the domestic mechanisms have failed in Tanzania, which is a requirement before you can utilize the international mechanisms. So you have four villages who have brought the case forward to the East African Court of Justice, saying that there's been a complete failure of domestic mechanisms to have any kind of recourse to justice and fair legal process. So this matter is today before the East African Court of Justice. We hope that with international attention that is being brought on the issue, that the East African Court of Justice would have the courage to fulfill its mandate and not feel the pressure of just the Tanzanian government. Because sometimes the instinct is not to oppose or upset the government of a country. So the hope is really that the international mechanisms will work for the Maasai when the domestic mechanisms, national governments have failed.
How has the Tanzanian government responded to the publication of your report?
The Tanzanian government, of course, has been very vocal. It came out with a press release denying that last year any burning of the Bomas took place or anything like that was done, which is quite ridiculous because we provide the press release of the Ministry of Tourism, which explains why these burning of the homes will be carried out for tourism. So they are basically, it is their word against their own documents. Since then, the Minister of Tourism went on to Twitter to threaten anyone who had collaborated with the Auckland Institute that they would be investigated, they would find those people and take them to task. So this has really worsened the climate of fear. But even more reckless were statements like, how dare you say anything about this? This is our internal problem. This is our land. This is our wildlife. And it is the Maasai also belong to us. Basically making the Maasai nothing different from a giraffe or a wild beast that might belong to the government of Tanzania.
So a lot of people in this country can kind of understand the hostility toward and oppression of native peoples, indigenous peoples in this country, and yet not think of maybe another country, like for example in Africa, having such hostility toward disregard of the rights of indigenous people. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that and since you were referring to the perception of, let's say, the Tanzanian government of the Messiah as primitive, is there a drive toward modernity and modernization in this and other countries that inclines people and inclines governing authorities to look down on indigenous peoples so that there's a kind of a, maybe it's not a class thing, but it's a desire to disassociate a growing, modernizing population from what's considered to be a more traditional way of life?
Well, of course, there is this drive internationally to be developed, to be modern, where ancient living civilizations are called developing countries. Countries like India or Tanzania or countries in Africa, which are the birthplace of humanity, are called developing countries. So this whole definition of what development means has been really driven by the West. If we look from Australia to Scandinavian countries to Canada to US, the way we have treated the indigenous populations right here in our own parts of the world sends a very significant message that their resources are for grabs, that their primitive, their way of life has to be annihilated. This is what development looks like, whether it is Ethiopia, which wants to modernize. Modernize means change your way of life and find a job as a plantation worker somewhere. Or in Tanzania, change your way of life and jump around and work in a cultural boom of a safari company or go work elsewhere as a guard. So this whole definition of development, which does not question destruction of livelihoods, which does not question destruction of the environments, is what we are grappling with. So I think it is not just about Tanzania and the government of Tanzania. This is the model that has been sent by the colonizing powers. Even if the colonial rules are over, we continue to colonize the mentality that development means to be like us, where we have eradicated the indigenous, where in a Congress there's not a single indigenous native person. So that is seen as the way to be. So that is the model that we have sent to countries like Tanzania, that being a Maasai, being with your cattle, is backward. The idea of modern is to have freeways, to have the largest dam, to have large plantations, the control of the minority over the majority, as well as the resources. So I think this is something we are grappling with, and it is an international issue. This is what we have to challenge right here in the United States when we look at the whole Dakota pipeline, or whether we look at what happens in Tanzania to the land of the Maasai.
Anuradha Mittal, again, it's Mittal, Executive Director of the Oakland Institute, author and editor of a number of books relating to trade, development, human rights, and agriculture. And we've been talking about the new report put out by the Oakland Institute. It's called Losing the Serengeti, the Maasai Land That Was to Run Forever. Anuradha, great seeing you again. Thanks for your fine work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.